struck right now, you should put guys on the street. Impossible. This is a government protocol. There were gunshots and explosions in the center of town. It's not my decision. They planned for a year. The mayor's office is in charge, and we're doing it by the book. How long do they plan to wait before they go in? A unit with body armor is on its way. 30 minutes, possibly. Okay, Reacher said. Good luck. He clicked off the call. No one spoke. Reacher said, I'm going out for a walk. 44 screws cost him just shy of 20 minutes, plus a lot of burn in his forearms. But then the panel came free, and he laid it down to bridge the gap between the load floors, a flat surface from one truck to the other, as planned ahead of time. He had thought of everything. The air in the crate smelled still and stale. Old wood, old canvas, old dust. The old world. The contents were exactly what Uncle Arnold had told him about all those years before. 10 identical items, all the same. Each one weighed 50 pounds. Each one was ready packed in a transport container. What Uncle Arnold had called an H-912. Wiley still remembered all the details. The containers had straps all over them, easy to grab. Easy enough to haul and slide and drag and push, one at a time, from the old truck to the new truck, all the way in, parted up tight, starting in the far back corner. Then a pause, and a breath, and back for the next one. Richard walked south to the Alsen-Alster Lake. The city was quiet, a learned response. Europe was full of explosions, factions and groups and people's armies. A big deal for a day or two, until the next thing happened. He turned east at the water, looping around. He was 2 miles from where Wiley lived, which had no inconspicuous place to park a panel van. But it made sense to keep it close by, which was a relative term. A circle on a map would be drawn cautiously large. Some of it would be water, but most would be land, of which Reacher could cover nothing more than a random and insignificant sliver. But doing something felt better than doing nothing. Walking felt better than sitting around. So he walked. 50 pounds was a hell of a weight, especially when you had to do it over and over. Wiley took a break after 7 units. Breathing hard, half bent over, partly nerves. A simple mechanical task, but the whole ball game right there, nonetheless. The moment of maximum exposure, but much longer than a moment. Close to half an hour already, with vapor lights all over the old docks, and the two trucks jammed together, rear end to rear end, like some kind of vehicular sodomy, complete with rocking and thumping and grunting inside, while all the time, half in and half out of a tumble-down shed no one had used in the last 30 years. Vulnerable. Not good. He took a breath and rolled his aching shoulders and got back to work. He dragged number 8 the length of the crate and up over the lip and across the last yard of the old truck's floor and over the flat wooden panel. Slowly, slowly, until it seesawed in the middle and clapped back down, and then onward into the new truck where he left it standing upright against number 7. He went back to the crate, to the far back wall, and he got number 9. He dragged it out and over and in, all the way. He took a breath and went back to number 10, the last. He pulled it away from the wall. The book was right there, right where Uncle Arnold said it would be. A khaki file folder striped in red, set in a neat receptacle made of thin plywood, with a half-moon shape scooped out for fingers. Maybe an apprentice's work, all those years ago. in the crate factory. The folder held mimeographed copies of typewritten pages, all held together with brass fasteners gone dull with age. He carried the folder in one hand and dragged number 10 with the other. He stood 10 upright next to 9 and wedged the book between them. He dragged the bridge back into the old truck and rolled down the new truck's door from the outside. He squeezed around the empty crate and climbed out of the old truck through its cab. He hustled around and got in the new truck and started it up. He moved it forward and backed and filled until he had gotten it turned around again, and then he drove it in nose first on the right-hand side, and he shut it down and locked it up. He repacked his duffel and closed the double doors and bolted the bolts and closed the hasp and clicked the padlocks shut. Nearly 40 minutes. A long time. He walked to the corner and risked a look up the cobblestone street, all the way to the metal bridge. Beyond it, on the main road, the traffic was moving, left to right and right to left. Normal speed, no sirens, no squealing tires, no flashing lights. Logical. He carried his bag and used the footbridges, from pier to pier, all the way home. Reacher walked halfway into the St. Georg neighborhood, curving west with the road around the lake. He saw nothing of interest. Cars, but none of them contained Wiley. Pedestrians, alone and in groups, but none of them Wiley. Eventually he stopped at a crosswalk. The main road ran straight ahead to St. Pauli. There was a narrow left turn that led to a boxy metal bridge. He saw cobblestones and moonlight on black water, all quiet, no movement. He gave it up and turned around and headed back. Folks in their homes were watching television. Hundreds of rooms were glowing blue. Live news, no doubt. The handgun rounds had been a pretty smart move. Explosions could be spun as accidental. Gunshots, not so much. Way to get attention. Textbook, literally. They had planned for a year. He got back to the consulate where the evening guard let him in and where Nagley told him the Joint Chiefs had issued the order to General Helmsworth. He was booked on Delta on the night flight, non-stop out of Atlanta. A consulate car would pick him up in the morning.
"A service star, for sure," Nagley said. "We had explosions and gunfire? He'll call it a war zone."
Then the phone rang. Griezmann again, who said, "There was no one in the parking garage, just 3 burnt-out cars still smoldering and bullet holes everywhere. It's crazy." "It was a setup," Reacher said. "But by who?"
"It would be a big coincidence if it was someone else."
"The mayor's office is in charge. They don't know the history."
"Can you give me some unmarked cars?"
"Impossible, I'm afraid. I'm standing by to be briefed, which at this rate might be tomorrow. Someone already said that corner of the garage is near the hotel kitchen, so we should look at animal activists worried about foie gras and crate-raised veal."
"I don't think it was them."
"Neither do I. But you see my point. This is going to be a long night. The mayor's office doesn't know any better."
12 hours until the Swiss banks opened. Reacher said nothing. Griezmann killed the call without saying goodbye. Later, Bishop's airport bus took them back to the hotel. They all went to their rooms. Reacher heard Nagley's door click shut, then Sinclair's. Then a minute later, she called him on the house phone. She said,
"When should we ask for help?"
He said, "Not before tomorrow."
"You say that every day."
"I live in hope." She said,
"Will it happen tomorrow?"
"It might."
"Will you come over and talk to me?"
She was waiting for him, standing in the middle of her room, in her black dress with her pearls and her nylons and her shoes and her uncombed hair. She said,
"What are you thinking about?" He kissed her, long and slow, and then he moved behind her. She leaned back and rested against him. He said, "Personally or professionally?" She said, "Professionally, first." He bent her forward an inch and found the tag on her zipper at the back of her neck, the metal teardrop, tiny but perfectly cast, a quality item. He eased it down past the clasp of her bra to the small of her back. He said, "Where do they plan to use what they're buying?" She said, "I don't know." "In Germany?" "That would make no sense, politically." He tipped the dress off her shoulders, and it fell and caught and fell again and puddled on the floor around her feet. She leaned back. She was warm. She said, "More likely D.C. or New York, or conceivably London." "Then they'll ship it by sea. We wasted a day, wrong assumption. Wiley was never headed out of town. It's a big, heavy thing that needs a large-size panel van. Driving is not the best way to get it out of Germany. They can't drive it all the way to D.C. or New York or London. Anyhow, it has to go by sea eventually." He bent her forward again, just an inch, and he unhooked her bra. He smoothed his hands over her shoulders, snagging the straps, pushing them off. The bra joined the dress. He cupped her breasts. She leaned back and turned her head and kissed his chest. He said, "Wiley drove the furniture truck straight here, 7 months ago, even though he never served here. He chose Hamburg because it's a port, the second largest in Europe. They call it the gateway to the world." He hooked his thumbs in the top of her pantyhose. She said, "He's going to put it on a ship." "That's my guess." "When?" He eased her pantyhose down. "Panties, too. Clumsy thumbs." He said, "When he gets paid." "Which could be tomorrow." He said nothing. She stepped out of her shoes and turned to face him, naked, apart from the pearls. "A sight to see." She said, "When should we ask for help?" He said, "Not this exact minute." He took off his T-shirt. She said, "Now your pants." "Yes, ma'am," he said. She rode cowgirl again, but this time reversed, with her back to him, which, visually speaking, had a complex balance of pluses and minuses. Overall, it was no kind of a hardship. He felt like an observer of a private pleasure. She was going for the big one. That was clear. Okay with him. Whatever worked. Whatever got you through the night. Chapter 34 Bishop sent the bus early because of General Helmsworth coming in. The driver said Delta's wheels down in Hamburg had already happened, just as dawn was coming up. The general was being met at the airport and would be driven straight to the consulate, where he would freshen up in the guest quarters ahead of moving to a meeting room provided by Bishop. Apparently, Helmsworth's interpretation of his orders was narrow. He would speak only to Sinclair, Reacher, and Nagley, who were in his chain of command, broadly understood. The others were not, which in practical terms was no problem at all. They had already decided among themselves to keep it lean. It was felt someone else's cryptic, half-remembered childhood legends would not survive a formal 1-against-7 across the table grilling. It was felt a casual atmosphere would be more productive, a smaller gathering. Sinclair and Reacher and Nagley had already been chosen ahead of time. So the others went to the regular office, and Bishop led the way to the room he had chosen. It looked a lot like the room in Fort Belvoir where Reacher had gotten his medal. Same kind of gilt chairs,
Same kind of red velvet, same kind of flags. Maybe the ceiling was higher. It was an older building. Nagley found four chairs with arms, and she set them in a square, like a casual group. All equal, just folks passing the time of day. Then Bishop left, and a minute later Helmsworth came in. He was a compact man, close to his middle 60s. He had a silver buzz cut and bright gray eyes. He was wearing battle dress uniform, starched and pressed, with two black stars in the collar. He had flown all night, but he looked in reasonable shape. Introductions were made. Hands were shaken, except for Nagley, who nodded politely. Then they all sat down, where Nagley had placed the chairs. Reacher said, "General, how annoyed are you right now, on a scale of 1 to 10? Helmsworth said, "All things considered, son, about an 8 or a 9. He sounded like a guy reading out a death sentence. Reacher said, "It can only get worse." "I have no doubt about that, soldier. But we don't have time for bullshit. So cheer the hell up, General. We're here to talk about the good old days. Yours or mine, Major?" A sergeant named Arnold P. Mason. He served in an 82nd Airborne unit. Your path and his crossed in 1955 and a couple of times later, but only technically. You were moving up by then. You won't remember him. "I don't. It was 40 years ago. But we need to know what you remember about his unit." "What is this, a folklore project? Oral History Month?" "We're looking at a guy named Wiley. As a kid growing up, for a 6-year period, from the age of 10 to the age of 16, his mother's boyfriend was a 20-year veteran of the 82nd Airborne in Europe. We think the boyfriend told the kid stories. We think the kid remembered the stories, and then many years later joined the army himself, because of them. That's how it's supposed to happen. I'm glad to hear it." "It wasn't like that with Wiley. It was like the stories were a treasure map, and he joined the army only because he wanted to dig up the treasure." Helmsworth said, "That's absurd. Now he's got it, and he's AWOL."
"Got what?"
"We don't know, but it's worth a lot of money."
"AWOL from where?"
"Air Defense, with the armored divisions near Fulda."
"Major, why am I here? Please tell me you had a good reason for bringing me to Europe."
"We want to hear the buried treasure stories from that old 82nd Airborne unit. We're sure you remember them. Every officer remembers his first command." "There were no buried treasure stories. Our boy Wiley got in a unit competition over smart-mouth one-liners about why they joined the army. When his turn came, he said because his uncle told him Davy Crockett stories." Helmsworth didn't answer. Reacher noticed. He said, "The uncle was really the mother's boyfriend, a 20-year veteran, Uncle Arnold. A polite honorific, possibly appropriate when the kid was 10, maybe a little weird by the time he was 16. Helmsworth said casually, "What were the Davy Crockett stories?"
"We don't know," Reacher said. "That's why we're asking."
"What years did the mother's boyfriend serve?"
"From 1951 through 1971.
Helmsworth was quiet a long moment. Reacher said, "General?"
"I can't help you," Helmsworth said. "I'm very sorry."
Reacher said, "How mad are you now?" Helmsworth almost answered, but then he stopped himself short.
"Exactly," Reacher said. "A 1 or a 2 out of 10. You're no longer angry, because now you've got bigger things to worry about."
Helmsworth said nothing. Reacher said, "General?"
Helmsworth said, "I can't discuss it."
"You'll have to, I'm afraid. I mean, I'm not permitted to discuss it."
Sinclair said, "General, with respect, You're talking to the National Security Council. There is no higher level of clearance.
Is this room secure?
It's in a United States consulate, and it was selected by the CIA head of station.
I need to speak with the Joint Chief's office.
On this issue, they'll say what we tell them to say. Why not cut out the middleman and tell us direct?
It was classified a long time ago.
What was?
It's a closed file. Reacher said, tell the story, General. Our boy Wiley is AWOL with stolen material. We need to know what it is. We're going to sit here until you tell us. I'd like to say we got all day, but I'm not sure about that. Maybe we haven't.
Helmsworth paused again. Then he nodded. He hitched his chair in and sat forward. He said,
I'll tell you what happened to me, and then I'll tell you what else was going on. This was Europe in the early 1950s. We knew the battle plan. The Red Army would advance through the Fulda Gap in strength and depth. Our first job was to stop their spearhead and then prevent reinforcement, which we planned to do by targeting roads and bridges behind their lines to halt their incoming armor. Maybe also power plants and other large items of infrastructure to degrade their capability. Except the Air Force was unreliable. Back then, there were no smart bombs. A bridge is a very small target. We needed certainty. We raised a couple of engineer companies. They were regular combat paratroops trained in demolition. The idea was they would jump with an explosive charge and hike, or if necessary, bite from the landing zone to the target and affix the charge with great precision to the bridge support or the power plant wall or whatever it may be. That was the plan. Back then, a paratrooper with an explosive charge in his back was the smartest bomb we had.
Good work, Reacher said.
Not really. What's the maximum they could carry on their backs?
From an LZ to a target? 100 pounds, maybe.
Which was the problem. 100 pounds of TNT doesn't put a scratch on a bridge support. It's a firecracker, and a power plant is even bigger. So we put the human smart bomb technique on the back burner for the time being, pending improvements to portable ordnance, which were generally slow back then. The glamour was all at the other end of the scale, which was the stuff I didn't know at the time. Los Alamos was busier than ever. They were working on the hydrogen bomb. They tested it just before I graduated West Point, on Bikini Atoll in March of 1954. It was a 15-megaton explosion, by far the most powerful in all of recorded history. It was 5 times more powerful than all the bombs dropped on Germany and Japan in World War II put together, including the atom bombs we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Probably more powerful than all the ordnance ever exploded in the whole world before, all in one split second. It was a big-ass explosion, people. So big, no one ever seriously thought about going bigger. They thought the atmosphere would catch on fire. Not that I knew any of that stuff at the time.
Reacher said, when did you find out?
Later in the 1950s, things were going crazy by then. We found out other things, too. For example, we found out we had 2 secret nuclear labs, not just one, not just Los Alamos. There was another place. They had a theory at the time. It was behind everything the Department of Defense ever did back then. In their words, they believed rivalry fosters excellence and is imperative for supremacy. It was written in stone. So they gave Los Alamos a rival. It was called Livermore, near Berkeley in California. There were smart people working there right from the start. They saw there was no point in designing a bigger bomb, so they went the other way. They designed smaller bombs. They got better and better at it. Eventually,
They built a whole new nuclear weapons system around a very neat new warhead called the W-54.
Good to know, Reacher said.
Now go back to my original problem. A guy carrying 100 pounds on his back was no good to me. But I was a commander with a tactical problem to solve. My target list included major civil engineering projects. Roads, bridges, viaducts, power plants, infrastructure. Could a guy carry 200 pounds on his back?
Maybe, Reacher said. But not very far.
Still not good enough. Still just a firecracker. What about 400 pounds?
No.
What about a ton? Could a guy carry a ton of TNT on his back?
Obviously not.
What about 10 tons? Or 100 tons? Or 1,000 tons? Or 15,000 tons? Could a guy carry 15,000 tons of TNT on his back?
Reacher said nothing.
Helmsworth said, "In the end, that was what they offered us."
Who did?
Livermore, the new lab in California. Truth is, their new weapons system was a failure. They got small, but not small enough. They packed the power of the Hiroshima bomb into a cylinder 11 inches wide and 16 inches tall. It weighed just 50 pounds. The same 15 kiloton yield as Little Boy, equivalent to 15,000 tons of TNT. But Little Boy was 10 feet long and weighed 5 tons, so Livermore's cylinder was a triumph of miniaturization. But unfortunately, it wasn't quite enough of a triumph. It was still too big to use as an artillery shell or a mortar round. There was no reliable man-portable launcher. It was a curiosity, nothing more. It was a solution in search of a problem. But, waste not, want not, they found a relevant problem. They gave the cylinder a new name, SADM, for Special Atomic Demolition Munition, and they gave it to the 82nd Airborne. Now my guys could jump with just 50 pounds on their backs and take out any road or bridge or viaduct they wanted. With nuclear bombs, as big as Hiroshima. No one spoke. Reacher said, "What was the SADM's old name?"
"Take a guess."
"Davy Crockett."
Helmsworth nodded.
"That was the name they gave to the W-54 warhead. I don't know why, but it took over. No one ever said SADM. They called the things Davy Crockett's instead. They came with padded canvas transport containers built like backpacks. You strapped it on and you were good to go. But it was unpopular duty. The cylinders leaked radiation, or so people said. Some folks got sick. They worried about cancer. But mostly they worried about the newsreel film they had seen from Hiroshima. That immense explosion. They were carrying the exact same bomb. Their orders were to strap it to a bridge support, set the timer, and run like hell. Very different than dropping it out of an airplane 8 miles up."
Nagley said, "How long was the timer?"
"A maximum of 15 minutes, plus or minus. It wasn't very accurate."
"That's insane. The Hiroshima lethal blast radius was 1 mile. The fireball radius was 2 miles. That's 12 minutes for most guys on a running track. Across mixed terrain, it would likely be impossible, especially if they had to fight their way in. They'd have to fight their way out again while waiting to be incinerated. It was a suicide mission."
Helmsworth nodded again. "It was a different calculus back then. We would have given up 2 companies to stop 1 million men and 10,000 vehicles getting out. We would have thought of it as a bargain."
Reacher said, two companies?
We had 100 Davy Crockett's, each with its own target. Carefully planned, widely distributed, like measles on a map. Except there aren't 100 bridges, or power plants, or roads or viaducts. It's a narrow funnel, that's why they call it a gap. There was redundancy built in. About half were to proceed to standby positions. In the spaces, linking everything up. Like a chain. You were making a radiation barrier. Like a minefield, with 100 bombs that could have been 10 miles wide by 10 miles deep, any shape you wanted. You wanted to force the Soviets to go left or right, where you were waiting. The file is closed. Because as time passed, all kinds of treaties were signed. You couldn't do it anymore. You couldn't even admit planning it. Yes, Helmsworth said. The SADMs were retired, but not strictly for military reasons. They were all brought home. They were not replaced. Eventually, nuclear weapons below a certain size were banned altogether. Sinclair said,
Arnold Mason is sick. His wife claims he told her the army would be interested. He told her someone would come.
Sick how?
Brain tumor.
It was a very long time ago. Most cases were much earlier.
There were others?
A sprinkling, Helmsworth said.
Reacher said, Such stories wouldn't make me want to join the army.
Helmsworth said nothing.
Reacher said, General?
Different recruits have different reasons.
Horace Wiley was a 32-year-old thief. I don't think training for a suicide mission and getting sick and then seeing the weapons go home anyway would have done the trick for him.
Helmsworth said nothing.
Reacher said, General?
This is classified at the presidential level.
Sinclair said,
For these purposes, so is everyone in this room,
Helmsworth said.
It's possible there was an inventory error.
Chapter 35. Helmsworth said, Initial cargo manifests showed 10 crates leaving Livermore. Each crate held 10 Davy Crockett's. 10 times 10 is 100, which was the number of bombs we trained with. Later, cargo manifests show the same 10 crates going home again, each one with the same 10 bombs inside. 10 times 10 is 100. All accounted for. All properly delivered and safely stored inside the United States. All subsequently checked and physically examined and counted in front of witnesses. There are exactly 100 in our possession.
Reacher said, So what was the error?
Those were the cargo manifests, 100 out and 100 in. They matched all known Army paperwork. But years later, at the Livermore lab, someone found an unsent invoice for an 11th crate. 10 more, Davy Crockett's. There was no coherent delivery paperwork. The production figures were ambiguous. It was possible an 11th order was filled, but not paid for, which is unlikely, which means the invoice was probably the error, possibly why it was never sent. That was the initial conclusion, Helmsworth said. Unfortunately, the crate manufacturer had contradictory evidence from an unlikely source, an apprentice's log. Showed 11 crates had, in fact, been built. The foreman of the shop had signed off on them all. The 11th crate wasn't in the crate factory. It wasn't at Livermore. And if 10 more bombs had been built, they weren't at Livermore either. So where the hell were they? Did they even exist? Half the argument was philosophical. The other half was better safe than sorry. So they started searching. Didn't find anything. Not at home and not overseas. Maybe the apprentice was wrong. But then the foreman had to be wrong, too. They went back and forth.
Until, Reacher said.
It was a split committee. The majority said the ambiguous production figures should be read the other way around, and that therefore the 11th order had not been manufactured in the first place, and that the invoice was incorrectly raised, or fraudulently raised, perhaps.
That sounds like a threat to make the problem go away.
Perhaps it was.
What did the minority think?
That Livermore wouldn't have ordered the extra crate unless it had bombs to put in it. The crates were prototypes of a standardized system. They were modified inside to carry the load, but on the outside they all looked the same. The error could have been in the delivery paperwork. The crate could have left Berkeley and gone to the wrong destination, or the right destination with the wrong product description. The inventory codes were very complicated. A single-digit mistake could have been fatal.
That's a lot of could-haves, Reacher said. That's a cascade of three separate errors. Wrong delivery paperwork, wrong inventory code, and the invoice was never sent.
Every year we were spending billions of 1950s dollars on millions of tons of equipment. The sample size was enormous. It was a frenzy. There was scope for every kind of error.
How long have you served, Major?
12 years.
You ever known anything go wrong?
Reacher glanced down at his pants. Marine Corps khakis, sewn in 1962, shipped in 1965, to the wrong branch of the service entirely, undiscovered for 30 years. He said,
"We're talking about nuclear weapons here."
Helmsworth said,
"In our history, we've had a total of 32 accidentally launched, fired, detonated, stolen, or lost. We closed the files on 26 of them. The other 6 were never traced or recovered. They're still missing. We know those numbers for sure. They're solid. Another 10 isn't outside the bounds of possibility, especially given their nature. Davy Crockett's were small and mass-produced. They were not glamour weapons. They were treated like regular, everyday ordnance."
How good was the search?
"We looked everywhere, literally everywhere in the world. We didn't find them. So the majority view prevailed. They never existed in the first place. The invoice was an intended fraud, but someone got cold feet and never submitted it."
"What was your personal opinion?"
"We were preparing for a land war against the Red Army in Europe. We had hundreds of supply depots all over Germany. The largest was bigger than some of their cities. The smallest was bigger than a football stadium. I thought the majority was sticking its fingers in its ears and singing la la la."
"Would Arnold Mason have been involved in the search?"
"Almost certainly. This was years later, don't forget. Those were the guys who actually knew what they were looking for."
"So those were the stories young Horace Wiley heard. The missing crate. 10 lost bombs as big as Hiroshima. Buried treasure."
Sinclair said, "Why would he expect to find them when no one else could?"
"Different people have different talents," Reacher said.
"Maybe Uncle Arnold gave him half a clue. Maybe he hit on something no one else did. Maybe he was the right kind of smart."
"This sounds completely impossible."
"I agree,"
Helmsworth said.
"Ma'am, nothing was impossible. It was the Cold War. It was a kind of madness. One time they sewed a microphone and a transmitter in a cat's neck, with a thin antenna threaded through inside its spine and up its tail. They were going to train it to wander into the Russian embassy compound and pick up loose talk. Its first day on the job, it was run over by a car. Nothing was impossible, and everything went wrong, sooner or later."
Nagley said,
"Does it even matter? Because who knows the arming codes? Were they ever issued,
Even if they were, they'd be split between two personnel. That was a basic nuclear safeguard. For 10 bombs, that's 20 veterans. Who, exactly?
Helmsworth said nothing. Reacher said, General?
Helmsworth said, It gets worse.
Is that possible?
You've seen the movies about D-Day, anti-aircraft fire, map reading errors, wind and weather swamps and rivers, immediate ground combat. The chances of landing two personnel in the same place at the same time were precisely zero, which would have left us with 100 useless hunks of metal. But it was essential we were effective. Therefore, the split code safeguard was considered a tactical impediment.
Considered by who?
Tactical commanders.
Like you?
I told my quartermaster to tell our armorer to write the whole code on the bomb itself with yellow chalk. That way the guy carrying it could get killed and someone else could still complete the mission. It was the Cold War. Looking back, we know it didn't happen. It felt like it could at the time. But the 11th crate never made it to the field. In which case, it has its codes in a top-secret file placed in a custom receptacle on the inside back wall. That was the part the apprentice made. 11 times over. No one spoke for a very long time. Then Sinclair said, Okay, 1 minute from now I have to call the president and tell him we may have 10 loose atom bombs complete with full arming codes, each one as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb, which means up to 10 world cities could soon be completely destroyed. Can anyone give me a reason why I should not make that call?
No one spoke.
Chief of Detectives Griesmann took the elevator to Herr Dremler's office. It was very slow. An original installation, no doubt, part of the rebuilding. But it got there in the end. A minute later, Griesmann was sitting uncomfortably in a too-small visitor chair in front of Dremler's desk, who first ordered coffee from a secretary Griesmann took to be South American, and then asked how he could help. Griesmann said,
It's about Wolfgang Schlupp?
Dremler said, You know, I talked to him earlier in the day. Purely by chance. That's why I'm here.
He said nothing of interest.
Certainly nothing that would help you shed light on what happened to him afterward.
What did you talk about?
It was all pleasantries. I saw him once at a business dinner. He was a nodding acquaintance, nothing more. I was merely saying hello, a professional courtesy. I hardly knew the fellow.
Were you trying to sell him shoes?
No, no, not at all. It's a politeness. It oils the wheels.
Do you go to that bar often?
Not very.
Why that day?
To see and be seen. I have many different places. On rotation, it's what we do.
We?
Entrepreneurs, civic leaders, business people,
wheelers and dealers.
Griesmann said, Did you notice who your back was to? Dremler paused a beat. Remembered elbowing in next to Schlupp, shoulder first, his back to the room. Who was behind him? He couldn't recall.
Griesmann said, It was a fellow about to run into trouble with the taxman. He overheard the whole conversation. He was very specific about the details.
Dremler paused again. He had a good memory, solid judgment. He was also nimble and creative. A man in his position needed such qualities. He rewound the tape in his head and played the day-old conversation from the beginning, from when he had asked how was business and Schlupp had asked what he needed. He skimmed it fast and picked out the important parts,
which were the words information and cause, and New Germany, and drivers and licenses, and the question about the American's new name, and the cause again, and the bribe, and the word important, and for the third time the word cause. Busted, he said. I have people in places that might surprise you. It would be hard for this city to run without them, and none of them has broken any law, myself included,
yet.
Which is to say, none of them has broken any law. We'll be ready when you do. Persecuting us will only increase our numbers. Prosecuting is not persecuting. Think for yourself, Herr Griesmer. You're facing a powerful force, soon to get even more powerful. It might be time to abandon obedience to your masters. You should side with us. Our interests are perfectly aligned. You have nothing to fear. Your job will be safe. Even in the new Germany, there will be petty criminals. Griesmann said,
Did Schlupp call you back before he died, with the American's new name?
Fremner said, No. And Griesmann believed him. He expected nothing less.
Sinclair made the call to the White House from the regular office. Elmsworth had left. Bishop had arrived. Waterman repeated his gloomy predictions that it was too late anyway, that the Germans would take half a day even to respond, and a whole day to brief in. Maybe more, because they were starting from cold. Then they heard that a NATO clause had been invoked, which only added to the complexity. Sinclair predicted a significant delay. Reacher called Griesmann and was told he was out in his car. His secretary said she would make sure he called back just as soon as he could. She sounded like a very pleasant woman. He hung up. Sinclair said,
Wiley is an AWOL soldier in the same city as you.
Reacher said,
I need his new name.
Good luck with that.
We could attempt a prediction.
Based on what?
We know customers were free to choose what names they wanted. We know Wiley used Ernst and Gebhardt at the rental franchise. Why choose those two? And if they were number three and number two on a list, what was number one?
That would be highly speculative.
What the MP business would call a wild-ass guess.
Is that better than a Hail Mary? Or worse?
It leaves a Hail Mary so far behind you can barely see it. It's a gut call, like closing your eyes and swinging the bat.
So what's his new name?
I'm not sure yet. It's in the back of my mind. Can't get it all the way out. I might need to check a book or make a call.
Call who?
Someone who grew up in Southeast Texas.
The phone rang. Griesmann, who said,
How may I help you?
Reacher said, I'm not sure you can yet.
Then why did you call me?
I hoped to be ready.
Sinclair said,
Gamble, Reacher.
He remembered raising his hand and brushing her forehead with his fingertips, and sliding his fingers into her hair and running them through. He remembered the texture, alternately thick and soft as the waves came and went. He remembered sweeping it back and hooking part of it behind her ear, and leaving part of it hanging free. It had looked good. He had gambled then. He said to Griesmann,
I need you to check city records for the development where Wiley lives.
Griesmann said,
For what name?
Kempner.
That's fairly common.
Single males, middle 30s, living alone. Not much else going on in their lives in terms of a paper trail.
That's hours of work. Are you in a hurry?
We're stepping a little faster than we'd like to be.
Then you better be sure. This could be your only wish,
No time to rub the lamp again.
Try it. Kempner. Get back to me as soon as you can, Reacher said. He killed the call.
Sinclair said, Why Kempner?
Why Ernst and why Gebhardt? Wiley grew up in Sugar Land, Texas, and then one day, years later, he was asked for three German names. What came to the surface? There's a lot of German tradition in Texas, an ancient community, a lot of success, and a lot of stories. Legend has it, the first German to arrive was a guy named Ernst. He founded the colony. I'm sure Wiley heard all about him. Then years later, another guy brewed a hot sauce. Now you can get it in plastic bottles from the PX or the supermarket. It's all over Texas. I'm sure Wiley has put it on his food all his life. The brand is Gebhardt.
Coincidence, Sinclair said. Both of them.
But what if? If Ernst and Gebhardt came from a subliminal association with growing up in southeast Texas, what would come next?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Wiley was proud of his hometown. That was in the original AWOL file, and Specialist Coleman confirmed it, Wiley's crewmate from the Chaparral truck. Wiley's hometown was all about Imperial Sugar, founded in 1906. Sugarland was a company town, side to side and top to bottom.
How do you know this stuff?
There was a movie, and I read about it once on a bus in the Houston Chronicle. Imperial Sugar was founded by Isaac H. Kempner. He was the father of the town, essentially. He built it. I'm sure he's very famous there. Maybe they named a street for him.
Hell of a gamble.
You made me do it. White said. They should close the port.
I'm sure they will, Sinclair said. I'm sure those discussions are already underway. The White House will call us back and let us know.
She checked the clock on the wall. The banks in Zurich were open for business. The phone didn't ring. Chapter 36. The phone didn't ring during the first hour, or the second. Reacher said, I want to bring Orozco on board. Bishop said, Why? We need an extra pair of hands. We're running short of time.
What could he do for us?
He's a good interrogator. If we find Wiley before we find the crate, he's going to have to tell us where it is. Orozco would be good for that. People respond to him.
How much does he know already?
Some of it. Sinclair said,
Call him.
So Reacher did, there and then. He told Orozco as of 1000 Zulu and 1100 Lima, he was TDY to the NSC. And for further detail, an immediate 1016 was required at the front desk number. Then he killed the call. Negley looked at him. He said, I'll be back in a moment. He left the office and walked down the stairs to the front lobby. He waited at the desk. The phone rang. The guard picked up. He looked confused for a second, and then he handed the phone to Reacher. It was Orozco. A 1016 was MP radio code for a report by landline. An immediate 1016 meant call back right away. At the different number, Orozco would understand, for reasons of privacy. Orozco said, Are we in trouble? Reacher said, Not yet. That sounds like the guy who just jumped off a building. How does it feel?
Pretty good so far. Like flying.
All we need to do is get the guy.
Are we going to?
How hard can it be?
What do you need from me?
I told them you're coming in as an interrogator. But you're not. You're coming in to get the Iranian out of the safe house. They've forgotten all about him. Or else they're set on taking a stupid risk. We can't let either thing happen. They'll kill him. So get him out as soon as we make a move.
Are you going to make a move?
I remain optimistic. How will I know which are the Saudis and which is the Iranian? I'm sure a man with your level of cultural sensitivity will have no trouble at all. What do I do with the Saudis? They can be collateral damage, if you like. That's hardcore, Roscoe said. There are 10 missing bombs. Is that what this is about? We just figured it out. What kind of bombs?
Nuclear bombs, Reacher said. Atom bombs as big as Hiroshima.
Are you serious?
As lung cancer.
10 of them?
In a crate. Roscoe was quiet for a long, long moment. Then he said,
I would want to bring my sergeant. Reacher said, I would expect nothing less.
I'm on my way, Roscoe said. Reacher hung up and took the stairs back to the regular office. The phone rang as soon as he got there. Sinclair put it on speaker. Not the White House, not new orders from NATO. It was Griezmann, who said,
There are 5 Herr Kempners in Wiley's development. 4 look unlikely based on age. The 5th is a strong possibility. His lease expires in less than a month. He has no employment records. The source of his funds is unclear. He's registered as Isaac Herbert Kempner.
That's him, Reacher said. That's the guy who founded Imperial Sugar. The exact same name. We found Wiley.
I'll pick you up in 5 minutes, Griezmann said. But please, just you, Sergeant Nagley, and Dr. Sinclair. No CIA. I haven't told Berlin yet. I'm out on a limb with this.
Sinclair killed the call. She looked at Reacher and said,
Congratulations, Major. Another medal.
Reacher said, Not yet.
Muller closed his office door and called Dremler from his desk phone. He said,
Griezmann is checking city records for a guy named Kempner. In the new development, where they think Wiley lives, where they had the unmarked car.
Dremler said, It's a common name.
I looked for myself and found 5 in that neighborhood. 3 are old men, 1 is a student. The 5th is 35 years old. He has a driver's license, which gives me access to his record, which is completely empty. There's nothing there. No speeding tickets, no parking tickets, no warnings or cautions, no insurance claims, no witness statements, no nothing. No contact whatsoever with the bureaucratic world. That's not normal for a 35-year-old. I don't think he's real. I think Kempner is Wiley's new name.
You have the address?
We should think ahead. Griezmann will go to the apartment. It will be inaccessible to us. But think like a traffic cop. He has a long, wheelbase panel van. Where does he park it?
Not on the street, because my guys have been looking for it and they haven't found it. And not in a garage either, because it's the high roof model, as well as too long. So it's in a large shed or possibly a small warehouse, near enough to where he lives to be convenient. It's there, right now, just waiting for us. It's what we want, not Wiley himself.
Where, exactly?
You need to ask the people you know. Did anyone rent out an old shed or a warehouse, possibly for cash? Certainly to someone they never saw before, who had some type of vague bullshit story for why he needed it. It's the kind of thing you people talk about, right? A guy who knows a guy who knows a guy?
Dremler said, I'll make you chief of police.
Bishop led the way to his office, which had an old-fashioned combination safe in the corner, as big as a basement washing machine. He spun the dials and turned the handle and opened the door. Inside was a mess of stuff, including 4 handguns, stored butts up
in a long cardboard box. He took out three and passed them around, one for Sinclair, one for Reacher, and one for Nagley. They were Colt government model 3.